From the Pavilion on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's From the Pavilion Lockdown podcast. On today's episode, Callum Guest and I are joined by Bowen Lexington's Jay Galani. We'll be discussing how the cracks seem to be becoming more visible in the county game as plans for a domestic season go to the ECB committee. We'll also be reacting to former England batsman Michael Carberry's comments on racism within the structure of English cricket. We'll also be picking a best but balanced cricketing 11 made up of just bowlers, and Jay Glani also picks his fantasy slip cordon later on in the show. If you want to contribute, you can do at FTPCricket105 on Twitter and Facebook, the place to do so. Send us your best 11s, your views and your fantasy slip corns if you like as well. Make sure you get in touch. So thanks very much for tuning in. My name is Ollie Slack. Delighted as ever to welcome on to the show my co-host Callum Guest. Thanks for coming on, mate.
No worries, mate.
And great to have on the show Jay Galani from Bowen Lexington.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me.
How are you? Are you good? How's the lockdown been over the past few weeks? You just said to us off air that you've been in Leeds at uni still.
Yeah, just finishing off bits and pieces. So I've had a bit of work to keep me sane, which is quite nice. But since then, it's been a little bit frustrating, just itching to get back out there on a pitch, really.
Good to hear. And like I say, itching to get back out on the field. What are your hopes for playing some sort of cricket this season?
Well, I think, you know, the best we can hope for is to get out there by early July. I don't know how likely that looks, but if we can get out there by then, we can, you know, maybe have the second half of the season. I think that's best case scenario.
Hopefully so. Callum, how have you been, mate? As another week in Ireland?
Yeah, it's all right. I've had a few golf lessons, which were much needed. So I'm out on the course hacking it about. Plenty of four rights out there, so it's one of those. I'm in the lakes a little bit.
What does that equate to on a cricket field?
It's basically a cover drive.
That's not bad then.
Well, I can play a cover drive on the golf course, but can't play one in the cricket field, so it's quite incredible, really. Yeah, it's not been too bad. The weather's been all right.
So you probably prefer that than hacking over to Cow Corner all the time, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, there is that as well.
Let's move on to the county cricket news. And George Dobell has been a busy man at ESPN Cricket Info trying to get all the information. And we spoke last week about the plans for first-class cricket championship season, where it would be three groups of six, all regionalised in a south, west and a north group. But there's fears now. There's fears that the first-class game won't go ahead over logistics regards to hotels, because you have to put players in hotels for four-day games, as opposed to, say, a 50-over competition where you can get in and out in one day. The main concern, though, is money, because a couple of counties are reluctant to take their players off furlough with no gate money to offset that expenditure. It looks as though there's a few cracks starting to appear in the county system, perhaps, Callum, that we already knew were there, but the COVID-19 situation has just made those cracks slightly wider and more visible to the public.
Yeah, I think we've said previously there's counties out there that have really struggled for money over the last few years. Obviously, going back to look at a county like Durham, for example, a couple of years ago, had points deducted where they couldn't pay and stuff like that. And it all comes down to, you know, these smaller counties rely heavily on the T20 Blast and competitions like that to get their gates in and to get that money in. And obviously, like you're saying, if that's not going to go ahead, you can understand that for them counties, it's not going to be feasible for them to take them players off furlough. We said there's obviously a few counties out there that have the money and will be able to do it. You look at the big counties like Surrey, Yorkshire, etc., and they'll be, you know, probably all chomping at the bit. But it's just the state of the game, isn't it? Obviously, it gives the ECB a chance and the PCA and stuff like that to look into a better structure maybe for the future.
I think the main concern is with that first class tournament they're hoping to run this year, obviously the adapted county championship. I think it's still that the T20 Blast should go ahead. They've pretty much written off the 50-over competition already, but that might come back now with doubts hanging over the championship tournament. There is talk about the 14 more affluent counties going ahead with it. Around about 14, 15 of them are happy to go ahead. And therefore, there's the three or four that are slightly reluctant to take those players off furlough because they don't see how they're able to make money for it and they won't be able to make up that expenditure. I guess the fear, Jay, is that potentially, if the Red Bull game was to come back next year, the ECB may use this as an opportunity to potentially cut down on the number of counties, and we might not see 18 first-class counties playing the Red Bull game again. Who knows after this year?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it's disappointing because county championship cricket seems to have been on a decline for a number of years now, but it's a difficult one for the ECB. It's kind of in a lose-lose situation at the moment. It's hard to think how to have a positive outcome from here. But I think what's in their best interest is to look from a long-term perspective, what's going to keep county championship cricket running for as long as possible and attracting the most amount of people. And I think, you know, if that means some counties not playing county championship cricket this year, although that might disappoint a lot of people, you know, disappoint, I'm sure, you and me, but if that's the best option long-term, then so be it. You know, if we can continue to have all 18 counties playing county championship cricket for as long as possible, if that means not playing cricket this year, I think that's absolutely fine in that case.
And the other thing is as well, if you'd lump, I suppose the ideal situation for the cricket side of things would have been to lump all the, if there was a T20 tournament or something like that, lump all the games onto Sky and get some money that way. But obviously with the football season now running a bit later on, the impact of that is how many people, you know, you're going to have, you could potentially have a situation where people happen to choose between watching a game of football and watching a game of cricket. Now, obviously, the title could go to Liverpool in a few games' time. So there could be that incentive, or that there could be that mindset of, well, why are we watching the football when there's a game of cricket on that, you know, there's nothing to play for in the football anymore. I suppose there's that kind of argument as well. They kind of need the, like Jay said, they kind of need the way up. If you put a county championship game, if you did play it over this period, how many people are going to watch it on Sky and sit there for a day? Yeah, it's one of those. Mm.
There is the option of the online streaming as well for the T20 competition, which I guess the counties could charge members or the public to watch, which could bring in a bit of income to try and even out that expenditure. And you're right, I think the balancing act is the key, and the ECB are, you know, not blameless over the years. And it's a difficult act in trying to balance the competitions because they want to put the blast in the height of summer to attract the big crowds and get that money and that revenue in for clubs. But equally, if you then push the championship season to March, April, September, A, are you really producing, you know, are you giving yourself the best chance to produce test cricketers? But equally, you've got no chance of getting any kids or anyone in to watch the championship when it's on a cold March day or April, etc. So potentially they could look at maybe shortening the championship and bringing it into maybe the height of summer. But how much cricket can you pack into those, you know, school holiday months? It's a tricky balancing act, but one they've tried to juggle over the years. And it'll be interesting going forward, whether it is with 18 counties or just 14. Let's move on to a slightly different matter now, though. And it's been an interesting week globally with a number of protests around the world, particularly on our screens on TV and in America and the UK around Black Lives Matter. And definitely, you know, it blurs the lines into sport as well. And Michael Carberry has shown that this week with a number of comments about the amount of diversity and black representation in the county game, in the cricket game in England. A couple of quotes from his articles. He said that black people are not important to the structure of English cricket. He says that cricket is rife with racism, and he doesn't expect anything from the ECB with regards to this changing. So pretty strong comments from Michael Carberry. And people may look at it, I guess, and think, well, why has he only said this now? But I guess it highlights the issue more that he potentially wouldn't want to make these comments all these years ago when he was playing, over fears that it might push him out of the county or the England team even further. I mean, what do you make of these comments, Joe?
Well, first of all, I think it's fantastic that Michael's come out and said this. I think perhaps during the coronavirus situation, you have a lot of time to reflect. And after his comments, I certainly did have a lot of time to reflect on a few of his comments. I think a stat that was up on your Twitter this week, that there was only, you know, one professional black non-privately educated cricketer at the end of last year, which was pretty shocking when you think about it. And I think, you know, the system in place for getting young cricketers into professional cricket is very biased towards not only privately educated cricketers, but people from English backgrounds. And I think it's, you know, it's nice that he's come out and spoken against it. But I think there's been a lack of education in cricket. I think there's been no real campaign or no real drive towards removing any kind of racism of cricket. Being a mixed race cricketer myself, you know, I've had a number of experiences over the last 10 years with comments and remarks from cricketers, not only from opposition teams, but on your own team. So it's nice to hear people come out and say that, you know, you're not the only one to experience this. Other people experience this. But I think cricket has a lot of work to do in catching up with perhaps other sports. You've seen, you know, football in the last few years. There's been a big drive to try, you know, kick racism out of the game. It's on adverts, it's in dressing rooms, it's everywhere. And I think that cricket could and should start to learn some lessons from other sports on how they're approaching this matter. And I think there should be, you know, changes to the system in place to encourage black cricketers, to encourage minority cricketers to take up the game and persist. But I know it's very difficult sometimes when you're sitting in an all English or white change room. You can almost feel kind of isolated at times. So, yeah, I think cricket does have a lot of work to do in that respect.
And Jay, would you be willing to share some of those experiences that you mentioned that you've incurred, whether it be racial abuse over the last 10 or so years?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make this about me. This isn't about me. This is about cricket as a whole and how the game needs to make progress. But I think the main problems you get is that these comments stem from, you know, a lack of education. I think it's ignorance, if you will. I think a lot of individuals think that some remarks made on the pitch are, you know, okay because, you know, people laugh at them, people find them funny, and often people go along with them and it's kind of normalized. It's thought it's totally normal. You know, only a couple of years ago on the pitch, a player from an opposition team in the East Anglian Premier League used a racial slur, and I went to the umpire about it. The umpire was next to me when the incident happened, and he claimed that he didn't hear anything, or it was something else that was said. And you kind of think in that moment, who do I have to turn to? Who, you know, how do I stop this from happening again? And I think that's just because when you raise issues like that, it makes people feel uncomfortable, and it is an uncomfortable topic because it's a pretty tricky one to get around. So I think that the people who have the authority in cricket, the officials, the umpires, the individuals, and, you know, the coaches, people who have some kind of authority need to be the main ones stepping up and really stamping out anything that happens on the pitch.
Thanks very much for sharing that with us, Jay. And you're right to point out that statistic as well. We put it up on our Twitter. It was originally from George Dobell from ESPN Crick Info. And he said that there is just one UK-born stated educated black man playing first-class cricket by the end of 2019. But it's also, you know, wider than that as well. If you look at stats for BAME represented people, then they make up 11% of the British population. But equally, no less than 30% of grassroots cricketers are drawn from those groups. That's a pretty healthy number given the percentage of population. But then if you go into the first class game and you look at the counties, excluding those registered as overseas, only 30 of 362 male players, which is 8.3%, and 10 of 106 female players, which is 9.4%, were from BAME backgrounds. You look at academies as well, 9 of 79 male academy players, 11.4%. So those numbers don't represent the initial amount of black and ethnic minority people getting involved in the sport in the first place. And you're right about people at the top of the game as well. The Telegraph released a stat in the week about the real lack of black leaders in sport. If you take 9 governing bodies in sport across the UK, including the ECB, only one of them have a black board member between them. If you look at just cricket, Wazim Khan was appointed in 2013 as the chief exec at Leicestershire, and he was the first non-white chief exec in English cricket at that time. He's since moved on to the Pakistan Cricket Board. But it shows you obviously then and now that the representation at the top of the game is really poor. And I guess, Callum, that's where the issue is, in that there's lack of role models and there's a lack of people at the top of the game who make those decisions, you know, speaking out and stamping it out.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the stats don't lie, as they say. But I suppose there's a few things I've probably got to add to that. The first thing is, when it comes down to state school educated and privately school educated, that's quite a fine line, because there's a lot of lads that would have actually been at state school and then got nitpicked on scholarships. So they'd be classed as privately school educated, but they could have potentially only have gone to a private school for their sixth form, for example. So that's where that line, and that would happen to a lot of academy players and stuff like that. They'd have had to have probably moved on to a private school to get that extra training in. So that's a little bit of a fine line. The second point is, state school-wise, how many PE teachers? I mean, it all comes down from the teaching and education. We talk about education as in the Black Lives Matter campaign and stuff like that, education and what can be said and what is appropriate to say and stuff like that. But also when it comes down to playing cricket, how many state school PE teachers are actually interested in cricket and want to push that into the schools? As well as the fact that the facilities as well, the majority of state schools in the country are poor. So even if you do get any cricketers that have of decent quality, you're almost pushing, you're almost forcing them out because they're not going to get the quality of training that they need to progress their game. And then thirdly, just having been in Australia for 6 months, when it comes to education of what's appropriate to say, I remember my first day there. Some of the stuff they say there, which is acceptable, and I was like, you can't say that. But that is just like completely acceptable in Australia, but so unacceptable over here. And that's where it's also a balance as to, you know, if an Australian comes over here and says some of the things they say over there, which is accepted, but then comes over to England and says it, and all of a sudden they're remarked, but they feel as though that's, well, it is accepted in their culture. So it's also that cultural balance as well.
And Jay makes a great point about the whole, how it's an uncomfortable topic to talk about, but that shouldn't mean we shouldn't talk about it. Because, for example, if there was a racist slur in our game, let's say a village game in my village of Bluntsham, maybe I think 2 or 3 years ago, had it been said, because it's an uncomfortable thing to say, we would have probably swept it under the carpet and avoided it. But I don't think it's not right at the time, and it's certainly not right now. I wouldn't feel right if that was to happen again. And I'd feel now that as a white person, although it doesn't affect me, we have to stand together and we have to stamp it out together and speak up and say that isn't acceptable. And I think, although, like Jay said, it's an uncomfortable thing to talk about, unless, you know, we as white people and everyone really, you know, all people from BAME backgrounds and us as well, if we don't stamp it out together, then it won't be eradicated. If we just leave it up to the people that are affected, then it will just continue being a problem.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. And I do agree, Callum, with you. I spent 5 months out in Adelaide playing cricket, and during that time, some of the things you hear out there are certainly a bit more severe than what you hear in England. And I, you know, 99% of people you play cricket with and against in England are, you know, fantastic people. I've made some friends that will be friends for life. I think majority of the people here play the game in the right spirit. And as you say, Ollie, it's about being able to, you know, recognise these events when they happen, isolate them, and I think more importantly, educate the individuals on why this isn't okay. I think if we can, you know, provide a better understanding to everyone about, you know, where this originates from, where it comes from, and why it's important to not engage in that kind of behaviour.
Well, hopefully we will see an improvement. And the ECB have released a statement on Twitter and on their website over the last few days about hearing Michael Carberry's comments and trying to do their best to improve. Let's hope they're true to their word. And you know, in many ways, what Michael Carberry said about he doesn't expect anything from the ECB, hopefully that is proved wrong and we do start to see a change. And thanks, Jay, again, for sharing your experiences as well.
No, thank you for letting me speak on the issue.
From the Pavilion on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Let's move on then and move on to this week's Best 11. A challenging one this week. I think predominantly we've been focused on batsmen and batting over the last few weeks. But we've done one this week for the bowlers. So I challenged Callum and Jay and myself to come up with a 11 made all from current day bowlers. And it's not the best 11 bowlers in the world. It's a balanced cricketing 11 full of bowlers. So you have to try and pick which bowler you think will be the best to go out and open, who could be batting 3, 4, 5, potentially your best batsman, and then your power hitters in the middle. And then your tail is generally probably your best bowlers. Callum, do you find this a tricky one?
Yes, now you've said it out loud. My team is very, very rogue, but I've got some serious players in there. I've kind of balanced it out to make sure that every single one of the players I've got in there has taken over 100 wickets in Test match cricket and also scored a Test match 100. So I've got a couple in there which is good, and also I've done it on where they'd play if they're a dogged player or something like that as a cricketer. So yeah, there's a few interesting ones in there.
How did you go about trying to set your team up, Joe?
It was interesting. I tried to, it's a bit difficult where you draw the line on players who are bowlers or who are bowling all-rounders, mm-hmm. who bat a bit. So I've been a bit cheeky and added a few players in who you might class as bowling all-rounders. But I just tried to base a lot of it on record. You know, do they have test scores? You know, if they're batting up the order, they need to be able to go big. And technique as well. I think that's important. I think you see a lot of batsmen lower down the order who can score a few runs, but you know, if their technique's not sure enough against the moving ball, up in the order, they're not going to survive. So I tried to go with, you know, batsmen at the top who could hold their own against new ball bowling.
I see. I mean, you putting it like that pretty much puts my 11 to shame already. I didn't go into that much detail, which is... I found myself looking at strike rate more than anything, especially for those opening spots. But equally, I guess, if you're averaging 4 or 5 and your strike rate's 30 or 40, then it doesn't mean anything. But so who wants to go first? Jay, do you want to read out your 11 then?
Yeah, of course, mate. So I'll start off with my skipper.
Okay.
I'm going to open up with the West Indian captain, Jason Holder.
Okay.
A bit questionable. Is he a bowler or a bowling all-rounder?
Yeah, I thought about him as well.
Primarily a bowler. I think he's got 3 test 100s. He went big against England last winter. I think he got a 200 red inker as well. So pretty useful opening batsman. And opening with him, I've got pretty new to England, Don Best.
Yeah.
So the reason I've gone for him is because I think he was quoted asking Somerset whether he could open the batting in the county championship next year.
Yeah, I think it was when Leach was obviously bowling during the summer, and it was at the point where they didn't need two spinners and he wanted to get in the side before he was sent out on loan to Yorkshire. I think it was either at the opening spots because Trez wasn't in the runs and all batting at 3. But yeah, he definitely wanted to try and chance his arm at the top of the order.
Definitely. I had the pleasure of training with him a bit out in Australia, and you could tell he wasn't just a bowler. He's got a pretty serious technique. I think when he burst into the England team against Pakistan, he played a few innings when they were right up against it. So I think he'd be a pretty handy opener.
And they talk a lot about his character as well, involving him in the England side. Was that something you noticed at all?
Yeah, incredibly enthusiastic, incredibly positive. He just got a can-do-it attitude. He doesn't back away from any challenge. And, you know, he wants the bat in his hand. He wants the ball in his hand. He wants to be in it in the field. So I think you need somebody like that as opener, especially, you know, in the longer format. After a long day in the field, you've got to be right up for it to go into bat. Not something I could do, but definitely Don Best could.
I will let you continue, but I think he was also quoted saying that he wanted to be the best backward point in the history of English cricket, which is quite an enthusiastic statement in itself. There are many club cricketers out there who will just be shaking their head at that statement.
Well, you've got to be confident, don't you? You've got to be positive if you want to make it at the top level. So at 3, I've gone for Ravi Ashwin. You know, he's been pretty good with the bat over the years, both in India and away from India. I think he's got 4 test 100s. They might be all against the West Indies, but they still count. Averages almost 30, so I think he could slot in at number 3 and do a job there. And at number 4, I've got a very questionable one. I've got Sam Curran.
I think that's all right.
Not sure. You know, I think you class him as a bowler.
If that's your finding is questionable, you're going to find a better question.
Can has got Ben Stokes in.
Yeah, and a bit more.
Steve Smith bowls leggies, doesn't he? No, I mean, when he debuted against India, I think, in test matches, and England were right up against it, he came out and played quite an aggressive counter-attacking inning, so... You know, I think at number 4, you need someone who's quite positive, who's going out there to score runs. And I think, you know, one day, as his career evolves, I could see Sam Curran kind of rising up the order and becoming a pretty serious batsman.
Mm.
At 5, I've got Mitch Santner from New Zealand. I think you might have already had him as well, Ollie. But yeah, I think he's a pretty serious player. I seem to remember, didn't he make 100 against England last winter? Mm. I think with BJ Watlin. So obviously, he can bat a bit, I think. He's got a pretty decent technique against spin as well. So I think in the middle order, I think he'd hold up pretty well. At 6, I've gone another slightly questionable one. I've gone for Chris Wokes. I think there are a lot of England batsmen or England bowlers who can do a Definitely, bit more than yeah. just hold the bat. So I think, you know, half of my team are English, but averaging, I think, nearly 27. He's got a test 100 and a really sturdy technique. I think you look at his technique, you'd probably compare it to someone who bats in the top order. So I think he'd do a job at number 6.
I think me and Callum mentioned last week as well, he came to bat at number 3 in the World Cup against West Indies at the Aegis Bowl. I think they pretty much knew they were going to win the game anyway. But I think Jason Roy got injured at the time. So Joe Root may have gone to open, I think, with Johnny Bairstow.
A couple of injuries that day, wasn't it? Was that it? There was a couple of injuries in the top order. That's why.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
That 3.
He also averages more than Keaton Jennings. Sorry, Keaton, if you're listening. He won't be. But
he couldn't make my team based on the fact he's got 95 test wickets and not 100s. But I was spewing. I couldn't put him in.
They're your own rules.
I was being tough on myself.
Going on to number 7. This is my wicketkeeper spot. So we're allowed one genuine wicketkeeper.
Yeah,
I've gone for BJ Watling from New Zealand. You know, probably been one of the most consistent keeper batsmen in Test cricket over the last 4 or 5 years. Number 8, I've got Pat Cummins. I'd call him the new Mr. Cricket, to be honest with you. I think he's got the complete game. He bats, he bowls, he can field. I think he bats somewhere around 8 in for Australia as well. So I think he'd do a great job there. Number 9, I've got a bit of a questionable one. I've gone for Yasir Shah. Not much to his technique, but no, he can play a few big shots. And I think he scored a test 100 against Australia down under last winter. So he can't be too much of a mug with the bat. At 10, I've gone for a big hitter. I've gone for Mark Wood. I think he's pretty entertaining down the order. And I think he scored quite a few runs for England, I seem to remember. I think he got some in New Zealand as well.
Yeah, he was talking a couple of weeks ago about his average in South Africa, if he hadn't got out the last wicket, or I think Marvin, before they declared or something, he would have an average over maybe up to 100.
Yeah, so I think very entertaining cricket. I think you want lower order, especially if you've got a few runs on the board, you go for the declaration, he'll come in and smack it about for a bit.
It might be worth just clarifying, we haven't told Jay to put Mark Wood in, so he comes on the podcast again very soon. That's the genuine inclusion.
Just a bit of good advertising.
Yeah, exactly.
Honourable mention there to Rashid Khan. I think Afghanistan, new test playing nation. And we've seen what he can do in T20 cricket. In the IPL and the Big Bash, he's got some serious shots, but went with Mark Wood in the end. And number 11, I think you've got to go with the best number 11 in the world. That's Jack Leach. Could have put him up the order for, I think that's, he opened up against Ireland when he scored that 92 at Lords. Yeah, I think the best one not out ever scored. So I've got to slot him in at number 11, and that rounds off my team.
That's a lovely team. Callum, do you like it?
Good team. There's a few players I've got in there myself, so happy with that. Mm.
Likewise. Yeah, I think I've got, again, similar players, perhaps in different positions. But yeah, a nice team. And it's weird, when I looked at my team afterwards and look at your team as well, Jay, I generally think that team could, you know, possibly hold its own. I know there obviously are lots of bowlers in there, but generally, like you say, averaging 20s, high 20s, or some of those at the top anyway.
Yeah, well, it would be really interesting to see, because you know, you get a lot of tail-enders who, when they start scoring their runs, they get a bit of boost of confidence, and they start asking the skipper to go up the order. I think I said it after a 20 not out once, and that was a terrible idea. But it would be interesting to see how they held their own up the order. You know, some players like Sam Curran, Don Best, you might see actually pop up the order in years to come when a few of the big guns retire. So it'd be interesting to see how they hold their own.
Gee, I wouldn't worry. If I got a 20 not out, I'd be asking to open. I get a 5 not out and I'm chomping at the bit to go up the order.
Callum, yeah, I was raising my bat.
Callum, do you want to go through your team?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so opening up, like I said, my I kind of was a bit hard on myself. Every one of these, I've got a test match 100.
Okay.
They've all got test match 100 and over 100 test match wickets as well. So, listen. Okay. So, opening up, Jason Gillespie, average of 18, high score of 201 not out against Bangladesh as night watchman.
See, we've got all time.
He's my stodger at the top. He's seeing off the new rock. Obviously, he got 259 test match wickets. And opening with him is Daniel Vettori. He averaged 30 with 6 test match 100s. And then 362. I've got Ashwin at 3, myself. 365 wickets and 4 test match 100s. This is where I might have to be a bit quick, because it's at 4, I've got Jack Callis.
Oh.
So if you took his runs away, you'd still pick him in that South Africa team as a genuine bowler.
It's a good argument.
292 wickets and hands like buckets in the slips. Without the average of 55 and 45 test match 100s, it'd still get picked.
I think they took a stat of Callis playing against India, and they put his bowling record by Zahir Khan's and his batting record by Sachin Tendulkar's, and his averages bowling and batting pretty much matched up, and I think beat Zahir Khan in the bowling department. So I think you'd pick him as a bowler or as a batsman alone. So yeah, amazing. I think that's a pretty good shout.
And So number five, I had Ben Stokes, but as I'm allowed a keeper, I'm going to change that, and I'm going to put, and I would have put BJ Watlin because I think he's a cracking player, but I'm going to change it and put Quinton de Kock.
Yeah.
Five test match. He's only 27 years old, so I feel like he can come into his peak. I think give it 5 years and he's carrying on. He could be, you know, regarded as one of the best keeper bats potentially ever. Or he's definitely, he'll be definitely in that bracket. I've then got Jason Holder at six. As Jay said, 202 red against England. He's got 106 test match wickets as well, so he qualifies. I've then got Abdul Razak from Pakistan.
Good shout.
300s, just qualified with 100 wickets dead on. Eight is Andrew Flintoff. Similar to Kalis Inc. If you actually take his batting away, I still feel like he would have been in that England team as a genuine bowler. And thinking about doing an England team all round, I think I would probably put him at eight and have Stokes potentially at six as your all-rounder and have Flintoff batting down there.
It's weird listening to Flintoff since his test career. He's often said, I don't know whether it's him just being a bit of a sort of Jack the Lad as he is, but he's often said that he didn't ever think when he was sort of running in, or he didn't have massive plans. It was mainly just on instinct. I mean, you get those impressions of those sort of maverick cricketers anyway, that a lot of what they do is on instinct. But it's interesting to think that there was very little thought behind it whatsoever.
Watching some of that 2005 Ashes back, I think just before it, he says that he wanted to score more runs. And I feel like he's obviously had a very good career. He obviously, you know, five test match hundreds and 226 wickets, you take it. But I feel like with that amount of talent that he had, I feel like he probably could have had a better average. I mean, he's just touching for just under 32. I feel like he probably would have liked to get over 35, 36. That would have been a quality career, but you'd still take it, wouldn't you? At number nine, I've got Ravi Jadeja. The average is 35. He's got a test match 100 and taken 213 wickets. Number 10, Mitchell Johnson. Also test match 100, 123 not out and took 313 wickets. And then my number 11, I've gone, you obviously went Jack Leach. I've gone Stuart Broad, but I've gone Stuart Broad pre-nose break. obviously got the 169 against Pakistan at Lords and has taken 485 wickets. So I'd probably still have him in as a bowler. But like I said, it's pre-Varun Aaron. He's just touched below 19. And you think of how many low scores he's got in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
His average before that must have been close to 30, if not over 30, surely.
Mm. It's been such a visual downfall, isn't it, that we've literally seen him completely fall apart as a batsman.
I suppose that's what happens. It's
just shows you, I guess, the mental side of the game, isn't it, as well, when you get that blow.
Well, I sympathise with him. I wouldn't fancy a Varun Aaron bouncer, to be honest with you. I'll be a square.
Anyway, I know you went for Jack Leach at 11, Jay, but due to his brilliance with regards to the Henley Test and also the 92 against Ireland, he opens the batting for me. It's that gritty, horrible opener. It's a classic old-style opener, along with his spectacled friend, Mitchell Santner, just purely on the 100 in New Zealand and sort of gritting it out. And I mean, that was such a boring Test match to watch, but Watling and Santner did the job and got the runs. I've gone Chris Wokes at three because he is well-known throughout the game. By many respects, he's a really great batsman to watch as well. Obviously, averaging 27 at strike rate of 50 as well. Four, I've gone Ravi Ashwin as well. Five, I don't think any of you mentioned Vernon Philander. I know he's just retired, but pretty handy batsman as well. I then tried to pick a middle order based on players who often give it a bit of a whack at the end. So Sam Curran comes in at six. Quinton de Kock, I've gone with him at seven as my wicketkeeper. And then eight, Tim Southee. Surprisingly, he only averages 17 because I thought he would average slightly more than that, but at a strike of 86. And so there's a good few
of them players you could put. I looked at Southie. I looked at the Grundholm, Southie, Darren Sammy because he took a five for five for debut against England and he's got 100.
And then I've gone Pat Cummins at nine, followed by Rashid Khan at 10. Again, only averages 15 in Test cricket, but a strike of 80. And then finishing off with Mitchell Starc at 11, averaging 22. Pretty good, decent average. Surprisingly, he averages more than Pat Cummins, 22 at 69. I did also put a 12th man in, India's Bhuvneshwar Kumar, who averages 22. Pretty handy batsman, but I don't think he's been in the Test side for a while now, or a couple of years anyway. But still a decent batsman. But yeah, I'm pretty pleased with my 11. Again, I looked at it and thought it could possibly hold its own. especially considering Jack Leach will bat for a whole day and not get out. Probably only be on about six, but at least he survived the whole day. So, who's 11 are you backing then? I probably would back Callum, probably because about six all-rounders in there, but I'll let him off.
I'll put the best night I've watched for your history in there. 200. You say Jack Leach could bat for a day. Jason Gillespie did bat for a day. Batted for two days, didn't he?
That's true. I wonder, how old is he now, though?
I think he's about 45, isn't he?
Yeah, Vincent's seen him get the pads on.
And I've got Andrew Flintoff to get. Andrew Flintoff's on my team as well. So the reverse swinging Yorkers are out of the question, because that's how we get out in the 05 Ashes. Must have got hit in the boot about five times. Flintoff kept getting in reverse swingers.
Well, that wraps up a pretty good 11, I think, for all three of us. A challenging one. But like I said, I think those teams would pretty much do okay in Test cricket. I reckon mine could probably just about edge up to a 200, maybe.
Still first inning score from England, isn't it? So
exactly, yeah.
I'm relying on Gillespie and Vittori just to see off the shine, and I'm getting Jack Kalish to fill his boots.
Yeah. How can you imagine Jack Kalish in the dressing room thinking, why the heck are those two ahead of me?
Yeah.
From the Pavilion on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Right, let's move on then and finish off with Jay Galani's fantasy slip, Gordon. How was this, Jay?
It was really interesting. I tried to think, you know, it was a bit weird for me because I can't remember the last time any captain let me anywhere near the slips. So I thought, what would I like in the slips? And I think you won a lot of chat there. Good bit of banter behind the stumps and somebody, maybe you can get a bit of chirps going and get in the batsman's head a little bit. So I've tried to go for, you know, an even spread, but quite an entertaining bunch, I think, that I've gone for. So starting with my wicketkeeper. I've actually gone for a goalkeeper in real life. Being a Southampton fan, I've gone for Southampton legend Kelvin Davies.
Okay, yeah.
Not sure remembered by too many, but just a bit of a personal one for me. Be nice to talk to another Southampton fan. There aren't many about, so it'd be nice to have a few chats.
So are you putting yourself in the slips then?
I'm not. I'll stand a backward point. I'll do a Don Best. And
okay.
I don't back myself enough to be in the slips, but I'll have Kelvin as a keeper. First slip, I've got Tiger Woods.
Nice.
Best golfer of all time, in my opinion. Honestly, just to pick his brains and ask him for tips how to stop slicing the ball. So it would be pretty useful. Past the long sessions as well. Can talk about 15 major titles.
And also, he's had a pretty eventful life, hasn't he? With all his back injuries and personal stuff as well. It'd be quite an interesting character to delve into, I'd imagine.
I reckon he's got a few stories.
Standing in the slips all day might not be so good for his back.
Yeah.
That might be
He'll have to do a Trescothic and kneel down.
Yeah, you get a lid on.
Yeah. So second slip, my one cricketer that I was allowed, I've gone for Andrew Flintoff. I think some of the best chat I've heard in the slips. I remember the Tino Best incident in England. It was brilliant. So I think there's one guy who's going to entertain you in the slips. It's probably Freddie.
Certainly.
Third slip, gone for somebody who can get in the batsman's head a little bit. And I think, who's the best trash talker in the world? I went for Conor McGregor.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I think if anybody's going to get in my head when I'm walking to the crease and marking my guard, Conor McGregor's going to do it. So I thought it would be a decent pick.
He must get a couple of warnings from the umpire, though.
Yeah, I reckon he's going to have to keep it quiet, otherwise he's going to be in trouble. But I don't think that's his start.
That is the epitome of just self-confidence has got him to the top from the moment, from the first fight.
I reckon he'd have a few interesting comments as well if you got a new batsman in. Yeah. And to round it off, Gully, I've gone for someone who can lighten up the long sessions, maybe a 200 for one, and you need a bit of a laugh. I've gone for Kevin Hart. Yeah, I feel like he could pick the lads up after a tough session and keep it interesting. So, that rounds off my slipboard.
Tiger Woods always comes across quite serious on TV, just like Freddie, Conor McGregor and Kevin Hart having an absolute whale of a time. And Tiger Woods just sort of standing there straight-faced, not getting any of it.
Kelvin Davies would be loving it.
Yeah. All his Christmases at once, next to Tiger Woods, Kevin Hart, Conor McGregor and Freddie Flintoff. I like it. Callum, are you worried batting with that slip cordon behind you?
I'd say it's probably one of the better ones in terms of catching it. As in, like, you're a bit worried if you nick off. Some of the other ones, there's absolutely, you'd rather nick off. There's probably a good run scoring shot, to be honest. But that one, I'm a little bit worried. I'm not sure what Conor McGregor's hands are going to be like mine, but as in terms of catching, but
scarred, probably.
Flintoff might be able to cover him.
I think pretty much all of those were in my head before I've even walked to the crease. I think I'm out before I've even got there, to be honest with you.
That's the challenge, isn't it? That's the challenge, getting chirped as you're walking out. But you've got good coverage, because you'd hope that Kevin Davis could dive across Tiger Woods if needs be.
Yeah, that was the thinking. I thought any transferable skills, I thought, let's have a goalkeeper in there. Maybe he can palm a few away, stop some buys.
Exactly. And Freddie can do the job of diving past Conor McGregor and Kevin Hart, which I'm sure is a sentence exactly. You never thought he'd do. Jay, it's been brilliant to chat to you. Thanks very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
No, lovely. Thank you very much, mate. Appreciate it.
And hopefully we'll speak again soon with some cricket to talk about as well.
Absolutely. Cheers, buddy.
From the Pavilion on Cambridge 105 Radio.
So that's all we have time for this week. Thanks very much for tuning in. Thanks to my guest, Jay Galani, for coming on, and my co-host, Callum Guest, as ever. We'll be back next week with another From the Pavilion Lockdown podcast. In the meantime, stay safe and well, and hear from us all again very soon. Bye-bye.